So welcome to the first class in a seven-week exploration of the writings of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This class sort of derives from an intention to prepare for the pilgrimage in the first week of April to Alabama, and with a stopover in Jackson, Mississippi on the way back to Dallas. That sort of derived from an intention to see what I would call the holy sites of the civil rights movement, with a pause at a brand new memorial for peace and justice begun last year, established just last year by Brian Stevenson and his organization, that honors the thousands, tens of thousands of lynching victims in the history of the country, and not just, and this is important, not just in the Deep South, but throughout the country. Lynching victims being a whole group of people in American history that have received so little recognition or honor, and so that's a part of the pilgrimage, but it will also stop in many of the sites in Montgomery and Birmingham. We'll also make a pause in Selma, of course, walk across Pettus Bridge, and we will, in addition, make a pause in Hainesville, which is the city actually not all that far from Selma, where Jonathan Myrick Daniels, a seminarian from New Hampshire, was murdered by a deputy of the local law enforcement when he stepped in front of a small African-American girl to prevent her from being, she was about to be shot, and he stepped in front of her and he was shot and killed. And so we'll stop there, and he is a saint in the Episcopal Church's calendar, Jonathan Daniels. So we're going to stop at a bunch of these holy sites in those 5 days. In anticipation of that, I read, and actually I started reading this last fall, and then I've been revisiting them since then. And actually, I read it, but I listened to them, because there's a wonderful audio version of this with a number of contemporary social, political, pop culture icons who read each of the chapters. And so I listened to it, and then I've been revisiting it in the text form last fall, and that is the actual writings of Dr. King. This was edited, curated by Cornel West, some of his introduction is really quite powerful, and then his brief little intros to each chapter are also quite illuminating and helpful. Dr. King, as you may know, is a figure who had such significance in the movement, but who has been tremendously domesticated and I would say historically sterilized. The radical nature of his message and his teaching, pushing the boundaries not only of American complicity in racial injustice, but also pushing the boundaries of justice as it relates to economic justice and justice with regard to our militarization in Vietnam and around the world. And so a number of these you're going to read, hopefully, and some of them will be familiar to you. Some of them may not be as familiar to you. And we're going to go into a little bit about trying to remember those quotes, those famous quotes. We've all got a famous King quote that we hold in our minds and our hearts. I know I have a couple. And then you read the broader context in which that quote is from which it's derived, and it adds tremendous depth and complexity, and you understand that not only was he remarkably able to offer profound wisdom and a concise, memorable statement, but he was also able to hold together, he was brilliant, so able to hold together this vast array of ideas, economic, political, historical, out of which he then he was able to make such profound sense. So we'll use this as our text. Carolyn, in the bookstore, in our Candor's bookstore, ordered several copies. There may be a copy or two left. If not, you can easily, there's no copies left, Rich says. So we'll order some more. You can ask her to order one for you. Or if you feel urgency about it, you can obviously order it from that store, which I'm not allowed to name here, that starts with an A and ends with a Zon. Yeah, so I leave that to you, or you can do as I have done and get it on Audible and listen to it, which was also a profound experience of hearing the words. So this is the primary text. We're not going to read all of it. Of course, you are invited, encouraged to read all of it. But as you'll see in the syllabus, and I'm clearly going to have to make more, and if you will, I need some way to take attendance. May I borrow one piece of paper?
Sure.
And if we can pass that one piece of paper around.
Yeah.
Thank you. Because this way I will know who's here, and then I can add you to a group list and send all the resources and materials, if you'll begin that and just pass that through.
Do you need an email as well?
I'll have your email address. Assume if you're a member in Realm, then I'll have it. If you're not a member in Realm and you're new to Transfiguration, if you don't mind jotting your email address, that will be great. So, quickly, we will be using the Radical King. Bob, there's a chair right here, front row, baby, front row, VIP.
Saved just for you.
Just for my friend Bob. You're great. So a secondary text will be, and this is optional. I commend it to you because it offers some, it's not really a reflection at all necessarily specifically on Dr. King and his writing or his witness, but in a sense that the movement that Dr. King led and participated in the ways that it continues to today, I find this to be an extremely accessible, readable, relevant, and insightful contemporary commentary written by Jim Wallace, the founder of Sojourners, a contemporary social justice organization. Jim Wallace is a wonderful writer and thinker, and he wrote this book a couple of years ago in 2016, I think, America's Original Sin. And I recommend that also. Today we're going to talk briefly about one of Dr. King's sermons/writings, which he gave on a couple of occasions. It's known as Paul's Letter to American Christians. I have 8 copies because I am going to ask you to go online and read it on your own at home digitally. But if you would prefer just to have a paper copy today, I have 8 copies. I didn't staple it, but if you want one, go ahead and take one and make sure to take both pages of it. So take it if you want it or pass it on. And that's going to be what we're talking about today, primarily. Paul's Letter to American Christians. You'll see in the syllabus that every week we have not only a reading from the Radical King, or a couple of chapters actually, but you'll also see that I have some suggested scripture. Because, of course, Dr. King was not just a movement leader, an organizer, or a public figure. He was, first and foremost, a pastor and a preacher. And so I have a hunch, and in just a minute I'm going to ask you for those most iconic phrases and sayings of Dr. King. I have a hunch that they are profoundly biblical. And when you think about what it is that he's saying, I have a hunch that you also know that it derives from the Bible. Whether or not you know where in the Bible it comes is a different thing. So what I've tried to do is each week assign a brief bit of scripture, a chapter or two from the Bible, some Old Testament, prophets mostly, but the book of Exodus, which inspires the collect that the Episcopal Church has for Dr. King's feast day, which is, by the way, April 4th. No coincidence that our pilgrimage happens then. But Exodus and the Exodus is sort of the foundation of African-American liberation movement, civil rights movement more broadly, and movements for justice around the world. So we're going to read, I'm going to suggest to you reading the first 15 chapters of Exodus. But then parts of Micah. Certainly Matthew 5, which I referenced briefly in my sermon today, but we should all know intimately Matthew 5 because it's bedrock for Dr. King and for all faithful Christians. 1 Corinthians 13, not just for weddings. Colossians 3. Amos, which is not a book of the Bible I bet you go to very often. is one that is very much a part of informing the vision of Dr. King and those who are leading as Christians, leading the movement for justice. Because, of course, the prophet Amos railed. The harshness of his language was primarily reserved for the powerful political religious elites who use their positions of privilege as a tool to subjugate others and for their own personal benefit. And he rails as the mouthpiece of God against the perpetrators of injustice in the world. So read Amos. You can read all of Amos because it's not a lot, but be ready. Read Amos 5, and I think that's enough. And it has one of those truly iconic verses that informs one of Dr. King's most iconic sayings. In addition, Mark 5, week 5, and Ephesians 4, which was the root of his one of his most famous sermons, nicknamed the Drum Major Instinct. Luke 10, the Good Samaritan, which informed much of Dr. King's whole attitude and philosophy, what it means to walk in the footsteps of the Good Samaritan. We will read or look briefly today at Paul's letter to American Christians. We will look at the letter to the from a Birmingham jail, which, if you haven't read it in a while, you should read it. And I would recommend reading the letter from a Birmingham jail often. I read it annually on Dr. King's national holiday, but you can read it anytime. And April 4th, of course, his feast day, is another appropriate day, because I'm going to just tell you, he's writing it to, he's writing it to me. I know that he's writing it to me. It was addressed to two Episcopal bishops and a number of mainline clergy, Presbyterian, Methodist, a rabbi in Alabama. And in it, he talks about his frustration, deep frustration with sympathetic white Christians who he viewed as being a greater obstacle to the movement of social justice and civil and racial justice than the Ku Klux Klan. And you should read that. If that doesn't make sense to you, read it, because he writes about it. We will read two different versions of Where Do We Go From Here, the text that he included in the book by that title, and a speech that he gave to the SCLC that same year by the same title. We will read a section from A Stride Toward Freedom and from The Trumpet of Conscience about how he connects the movements for racial justice with movements for economic justice. He pivots after the passage of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts. As you know, many of you no doubt know, he pivots in his career and his attitudes and his mission to moving for economic justice, not just racial justice. We'll read The Drum Major Instinct, which is a wonderful, marvelous sermon. We'll read about his reflections on the Black Power movement, which is contemporaneous with his work, but not something of which he explicitly joins. We will read the great speech that he delivered at Riverside Church the year before his assassination, called Beyond Vietnam, which is one of the most sort of profound and sort of comprehensive visions of what he thought he was doing and what it is that Christians should be doing. And then, of course, we'll conclude with the famous I've Been to the Mountaintop sermon given the night before his assassination in Memphis. Sound good? Is something missing that you really want to read?
There was also a really fine sermon at the National Cathedral that might be. I'd be happy to check it out.
We will find it. So we're going to add some reading to your list. But let me just let you know, this is. I really don't think. I mean, you showed up here today. I don't think any of you are going to, you know, like labor over this reading. It is Dr. King's poignant, at times very funny, deep, but extraordinarily relatable, accessible writing. And he writes the way that he speaks. He is first and foremost an orator, so he writes in the way that you speak. And when you write as a speaker, you write in ways that you can access. So I think that you will not struggle to do this reading. Oh, I see now what I've done. Did any of you get my did I hand out my lecture notes? No? Okay. We're gonna wing it. I grabbed all these piles of papers and I forgot the one thing I needed most. So I wonder what are the phrases when you think of Dr. King's speaking, preaching, writing, his public witness, what are those sayings, those phrases that stand out to you, that have been inspiring to you, and that you come back to again and again?
We shall overcome.
We shall overcome. Not just Dr. King's, but certainly one that he said often. Yes, please, John.
I had a dream.
I have a dream. Yes, please.
From George's Stone Mountain.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. At the end of the I Have a Dream, although he used that on a couple of different occasions, when he talks about...
Let freedom ring.
Yes. Citing different American locations, including some of the most prejudicial, and talking about freedom ringing even in those places. You'll notice that I Have a Dream speech is not included in the readings. My assumption was that was probably the one with which we are most familiar, at least the last, say, 5 to 7 minutes of it. Because actually... a lot of it he wrote out, and the lore about that day is that people were getting a little bored because he had written out this long speech, and of course there were 500,000 plus people there, and he had all these thoughts and points he wanted to make, and it was getting a little sleepy. And as I understand it, Mahalia Jackson is behind him and says, "Tell him about your dream, Martin," and he goes off script. And so all the bit of that speech that you know, that we know, is all him totally off script. And he just sets it all aside. So the I Have a Dream thing, that's completely extemporaneous. Yes?
About the white moderate being the bigger stumbling block because of their insistence to wait for justice.
Yeah. The wait. That letter from a Birmingham jail.
Yes.
Others? Please, Lindsay.
Darkness, can that drive out darkness?
Yes.
Yeah. Hate cannot drive out. Hate, only love can do that. Yep, I think you're going to read that. George.
Let justice roll down like a mighty river.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you get that?
I wonder where that comes from.
Do you know that they didn't give the psalm on his thing in Washington?
Hmm. They quote him as though it's not the Bible.
As though it was not the Bible.
Yes, as though he coined that phrase. It was about 3,000 years old.
They may have changed that by now.
Yes. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And he says that becomes, the use of that phrase is a thread he pulls through his entire life and career. So you will hear it again and again, or read it again and again, as the case may be. Others?
He requests the Constitution.
Say again?
He requests the Constitution. All men are created equal with inalienable rights.
Gotcha. Yeah. Thank you. So when he cites the Declaration of Independence, absolutely.
Idea of a moral community. Church.
The beloved community, yes, indeed. So the idea of the church as the beloved community. We are not going to spend a lot of time, unfortunately. Much more could be written about that, about the beloved community. I have another book I did not suggest because, you know, this could get quite cumbersome. By a historian, Charles Marsh, who has written the most my most prized biography of Bonhoeffer, also wrote the history. His actual special area of scholarship is the beloved community. And the Bonhoeffer thing was something he wrote while he was on sabbatical, which just shows his genius. So he has written quite a lot about Dr. King and the movement, the civil rights movement, as being an effort, the Christian thread of the civil rights movement as being an effort towards the establishment of the beloved community. And so I highly recommend, I can't remember the title of the book off the top of my head, Charles Marsh has also written a memoir of his own childhood growing up in as a white child in the racist Deep South, and his adult reflections on that. As a historian, it's a profound book. So I recommend those as well. I also have on here three different pieces of history. So if you want to go deeper with the contemporary history and you feel like your own history classes in high school or college were inadequate to the task of giving you the tools to know everything, Taylor Branch has written the three most important volumes of the history of the civil rights movement from 1955 to 63, 63 to 65, and 65 to 68. Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. They're incredibly readable. They're actually page turners in a real sense because the era was so riveting and fast paced. So if you feel like you want to go deeper in your history, I recommend that. Lastly, I'm going to give you a chapter in a couple weeks of a book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree by one of the sort of most important contemporary theologians, a man named James Cone, who died just a couple of years ago, who wrote this book about understanding God's identity as layered atop systemic racial injustice, and writes profound and provocative books. He wrote an incredible book about Dr. King and Malcolm X. But he has written this, and one of the chapters is particularly pertinent to us because he's reflecting on Dr. King. And it's chapter 3, and I'm going to make that available to you so that you don't have to buy that book. I'm just going to give you that chapter. You can certainly buy the book. And the James Cone family would love for you to buy the book, I know. But if you don't want to read all of it, I'll give you that chapter. And I'll make that digitally available. All right. So I passed out Paul's letter to American Christians. He first delivered this in 1956, so very much at the front end of his preaching and teaching career. But if you remember your historical chronology, November 1956 is at the very tail end of the Montgomery bus boycott. So this is roughly a year into the bus boycott, and he is still the pastor and at the pulpit of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and he is preaching his way through that monumental effort of nonviolent resistance. As a testament to his genius, he has the creative and imaginative capacity to not just try to write inspiring things or preach inspiring things about the bus boycott or about anything about that. He has the spiritual imagination to create a whole letter as though Paul, the Apostle Paul, was writing, as though we found a letter in some sort of like stone jar, you know, at the Dead Sea or something, that Paul had written American Christians in the 1950s. And it's profound, and it gets, and this is why I wish I had my notes, because I could tell you some of the themes, but it gets to the heart, and when you read it, you will recognize very early in his career, which was too short, as we all know, the themes that undergirded everything he did for the rest of his life and ministry. So let me borrow this because I will remember them as I look at it. Things like the flagging progress, moral progress of American society behind scientific and other kinds of progress, so that we have worked economically, we have worked militarily, we have worked scientifically to progress as a society, and meanwhile we have flagged in our moral progress. It's going to be a thread he picks up again and again. He was carefully critical of capitalism and was labeled, I would say, slandered because of the stigma associated with the word in that era. He was labeled a communist, but you're going to read a whole bunch of stuff that shows that what he was doing in his preaching and teaching was talking about capitalism and its shadow sides, but also equally talking about other economic or political philosophies and their shadow sides. So all he was trying to do is raise up an awareness of what capitalism does, and it creates permanent captive classes enslaved to a system that keeps them that way, poor. He talks about that in 1956. He talks about okay.
First Samuel.
Excellent. Yes. Yes. Great.
David just killed Goliath.
Oh, yes. This is when he, one of the first moments when he talks about and laments the deep disunity of the church in the United States. And cites at that time the number of denominations with which he was familiar. Of course, the number has only grown since then, 250 plus, and how lamentable that is. So remember, this is from Paul that he's writing all this, and he talks about how the church is a broken witness to the body of Christ. He also talks about, in one of his earliest times, how Sunday morning is the most segregated hour of the week. Something that, if you're not familiar with that famous quote, I wondered if any of you would cite it earlier, is still troublingly accurate, that the 11 o'clock hour, a Sunday morning, is the most segregated hour of the week. Think about that. He talks about yes.
American church. Are you saying that you've got all these churches that say we're the best?
Yes.
Or that some of them were not, at that time, were not again, were ignored civil rights?
I would say it was more the first and less the second. Of course, he would acknowledge the second, but he was talking about how the claims of every church to be right.
Okay.
And that sort of moral superiority, how completely messed up that is. He says it better than I just did, but that.
Okay.
All right. So I want to play for you a clip of this because we have a recording of it at a later date from the. Not we don't have a recording of it from this first delivery of it at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, but we have a clip of it from later. And there's nothing like hearing him. So in your syllabus, I've given you links. And you can just go on YouTube and you'll be able to find them to be able to hear him delivering some of these famous speeches and sermons.
Oh.
It thought that I was done with it. I'm sorry, it's so hot in here. I'm so sorry. I promise I'm hot too. Under my polyester. It should be HDMI.
Life is to do the will of God, come what may. Oh, America, will you hear that and will you follow that before it's too late? Then I must say one other thing.
Can you hear?
You know, I said to the Church of Carmen. That love is the principal thing, and I want to still say that to America. America, I want you to know that you might move high in the world. You might come to the point that you are mighty eloquent in your speech. You might master the English language. All of your grammar might be perfect. You might move high. You might move with all of the eloquence of an articulate speech. But I want you to realize, America, that it is still true that even if you can speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not love, you are become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Yes, America, you may have the gift of prophecy. So that you can understand all the mysteries, you may have scientific insight. So that you can break out into the storehouse of nature. Yes, America, you might have all of the mysteries and understand them so that you can remove the mountains of material obstacles. You may move all of the mountains that stand before you. But unless you have love, it means nothing. But even more, America, you may give your goods to feed the poor. You might tie power high in philanthropy. You may give great gifts to the United Appeal. You may give great gifts to your colleges and universities. You may give big money. But if you have not love, it means nothing. Yes, and you may even give your body to be burned. You may even stand up and die life as a martyr. You may stand before the universe as that honorable person who was willing to stand up as a martyr. But even if you do that and you have love, it means nothing. Yes, America, it's possible to be self-dissenter in one's denial that self-right righteous. It is possible.
I don't know why it's doing that.
For one generous in order, yes, America, it's possible to be self-dissenter in one's denial that right righteous and self-sufficed. It is possible for one generous in order to feed his ego, and it is possible for one to be pious in order to feed his pride. And so man has a tragic capacity of being able to make a heightening vice to a tragic, a heightening virtue to a tragic vice. Yes, even if you give your goods to feed the poor, have not love, it means nothing. You may build all of your great institutions. You may have all knowledge. You may build your great Harvard and your great Yale. You may have all of your institutions of learning and all of your PhDs and MAs and ABs. But if you have no love, America, it means nothing. I still want you to know that love is the principal thing in the universe. I want you to know that at the center of life stands love, and that it is the most durable in the world. And if you follow that, America, you will build a great nation. I must get ready to leave now. Timothy sent to deliver this letter, and I must take leave to go to another church. But just before leaving, let me say this to you, America. I said a lot to you about loving. I said a lot to you about being moral and living noble principles. And I know that you often try to do that. But I want to say something to you about the meaning of the gospel. In trying to live up to the high and noble principles of this religion, you often fall short. And I know how you felt sometimes. You tried to live up to it and you didn't quite make it. Sometimes you felt that you could do it alone, but the more you tried, the more you discovered that you couldn't do it alone. And I know how you were caught up in the tragic dimensions of sin, both individual and collective. I see how, as you live life, on every level of your life, you're confronted with sin, and sometimes you have to cry out, as I have to cry out, the good. good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not, that I do. Then as you try to follow the law of love, you find yourself saying, oh, wretched man that I am. You discover somehow that the more you try, the more you discover that you can't do it alone. And oh, you end up in despair. You end up in a tragic state. You feel that you have lost out. Yes, I have been like that. When I came to that point, when I came to the point of feeling that I couldn't make it alone, when I came to the point of realizing that I was too weak to make it, I discovered something else. I reached out and saw breaking out of eternity into time the powerful dimensions of God's grace. And where sin abounded, grace abounded even more exceedingly. So I want to say to you, America, reach out. If you reach far enough, you will discover God's grace. It is that grace that can lift you from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope. It is that grace that can lift you from that midnight of sorrow to the daybreak of joy. It is that grace that helps you to see that by the grace of the Almighty God, you can live in this world and you can live this life. You can see the face of the Almighty God with all of his eternal principles. In the midst of man's tragic sin, stand God's amazing grace. I must say goodbye to you now. Maybe I will not see you, but I will meet you in God's eternity. May the grace of God and the sweet communion of the Holy Spirit be with you today, tomorrow, and even forever. This is 11. And now comes the living of it.
I wonder, with just a couple minutes left, what it is that you want to make sure we explore. I want to cover material that you are interested. We're going to find this sermon delivered at the National Cathedral. I wonder if there is anything in particular that you hope, a topic, a theme, perhaps a particular address or sermon that you want to make sure that we reflect on. Alan, yeah.
The continued nonviolent struggle for justice.
Yeah. Awesome.
That's a big thing for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in one of his books, and we're going to read one of the chapters, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, written in 1965. Is essentially his, he speaks to that specifically. And so we're not going to read the whole thing, but we're going to read a section of it. Why he continues to double down on nonviolence. And though speaking quite poignantly of his understanding of why it is that people riot.
Yes.
And that became something very important. And it actually became fodder for his critics and those who wanted to brush him to the side, is that he seemed to have a type of sympathy for people who felt like they had no recourse in life other than to riot. And he speaks poignantly about them, while also himself doubling down on the power of nonviolence. Yes, please.
When I was in college, many moons ago, I read an essay by him called The World House, which kind of speaks, I think, to that community.
Okay.
Idea, maybe.
Yeah, if you can find it. Yeah.
I'll see if I can.
Great. Please do.
It stuck with me.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. Yes, Cherry.
I was about to say the same thing when Ron got called on first, but I would like to know, speaking of his idea of justice, and we've been exploring restorative justice.
Yeah.
And I would like, how do those
indeed
fit together?
Yeah, I'm going to try to find the clip which made the rounds on social media not long ago of him being interviewed, like on NBC or something, and talking with somebody in which he plays with the idea of the sort of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps.
I have it.
Yeah. So he's playing with this, and he's like, that's great, this like American principle of like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, but what if you never had any bootstraps?
Yes.
No shoes.
What if... What if you don't have anything and you have been given nothing ever to pull yourself up by? You can't possibly expect a whole class of people to do that. And he does, he's talking about, I don't know that he uses a specific language as restorative justice, but that is exactly what he's talking about. So let me try to find a clip that might be helpful to that. Cherry, thank you. Others, before we turn back to John. Okay. Yeah, John.
On this trip, will we hear from witnesses?
Well, I'm trying to put together some opportunities for us to meet with folks on the ground. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do we have witnesses in our congregation?
I'm sure we do. So if you have stories from your own work and efforts in that era, and you are willing to share them, we will let me know, and we will create time and space in these classes if you want to, or on the pilgrimage itself, certainly. All right, we are... yes, please.
I was wondering if we're going to look at Dallas at all?
We are not... In this class, we're not going to look specifically at Dallas, but my goal is to either before we go on pilgrimage... Or after we come back, I think it's going to have to be before. We're going to go to the lynching site here in Dallas. Because, of course, Dallas, not immune from this. And we have a tragic lynching site right here in Dallas. So those who will participate in the pilgrimage and anyone else, and we'll publicize that, probably we'll do that this Sunday before we go on pilgrimage as a sort of reminder that this isn't just something that happens in Montgomery.
There was a horrible incident in Plano. I grew up here, so Mom grew up here too. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, reading in the notices, that at least some of what we'll hear on Wednesday nights in Lent will speak to the Dallas.
Yes.
In some of this context.
So our Lenten program is... oriented around who is my neighbor, and we're going to hear from a variety of different people, several local, who are talking about how we embody the virtue of that story and the virtue of love of neighbor here, even today. We are out of time. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Thank you.